Welcome into Wins and Losses. I'm your fearless host, Clay Travis. Encourage you to go check out the entire catalog of Wins and Losses podcast. Just letting you guys know, it took a little bit to get the audio ironed out. So if you're listening here at the beginning, trust me, after about 7 or 8 minutes, it's going to be great for the rest of the conversation. But it's going to be a little bit spotty in the beginning before we get the audio issues worked out. Just want to let you know, Nate's awesome. We had a great conversation. You're going to love it. But it gets better. So I don't want you all tweeting me, being an audio guy, saying, hey, the audio's not great for the first few minutes, and then it's going to be great after that. So just trust me on it. And thanks for listening to Wins and Losses. This week, fun guest, a guy who's almost exactly my age. I think graduated from high school in Nashville in the exact same year. He is Nate Bargatze. He's been doing comedy, I think, basically since he graduated from high school, and he is killing it of late. He's got a Netflix special. I want to bring him in. First of all, thanks for being on, Nate. Secondly, am I correct? Are we the exact same year graduating from Nashville area high school?
97.
Yep, 97 represent. Which used to be a big deal back when you were in high school, the class of 97. So you are 40 years old as well as I am. And you graduate from high school and immediately decide you're going to be a comedian. Is that what you did? Like, at what age did you decide this is what I'm going to attempt to do in my life?
No, I started when I graduated DCA is where I went. And then, so I graduated in 97, and I was like, thought about doing comedy then, but I didn't start until 23. I just like did whatever jobs. Like, I worked at Applebee's. I delivered, like, you know, I do this to Mac. I say this to Mac now, but I've never had a job that I can't go back to. Like, it's like nothing's changed. Every job I had is just like lifting objects, just picking up stuff. So. I moved to Chicago when I was 23.
So you graduate from high school at 18. A lot of people decide to go to college. You went to Donaldson Christian Academy, which is a private school. How did you decide not to go to college?
Well, we got to go there because my dad was a teacher too, so that's what there. It's not, and I barely graduated. So I tried to go to college, but there was no sign that I was like, hey, this kid should be in college. I went to Volunteer State for 1 year. I tell this joke to my act. I went 1 year, no credits, took all remedial classes. In my act, when I say it's a good local joke, I say I went to Volunteer State, which is a Vanderbilt Gallatin. And just a strict local joke that no one gets. But they, so I went there, and I was there for a year, no credits. Then went to Western Kentucky for one semester. Still no credits, spelled bowling. So it just wasn't happening. And then that's when I kind of got out and did like whatever job. And then so I decided to go try. I read water meters. My final job was reading water meters at Mountville.
So I'm curious, so you go to Western Kentucky for a semester, and it's not like Western Kentucky is the most elite academic institution on the planet, neither is Vol State. How did you end up getting no credits? Like, what did you do at Western Kentucky?
Yeah, man, it's hard to do, but I did it. And I just didn't go to class. I had an unbelievable time. The greatest, whatever, semester, 4 months of my life. And I just partied and like I just didn't go to anything. And I was already in like when I went to Ball State, I think I mean my ACT was like real bad. You remember you took I forget what is it? It's like an 18 is like the lowest or worst. And I was either an 18 or right under 18. It was real bad. And I was like a college athlete. Like, you know who took him a year. Was his name John Henderson, the guy that played in Tennessee? And then
yes.
He played in Jacksonville. He was like in our group, like my buddy's group, when we took the ACTs. And my buddy said he just filled his thing out and put his head down and went to sleep because it didn't matter. He was going to do it like. But I didn't have that luxury.
So
I just didn't have any. I just didn't have any good grades. Like, school was just like, I just didn't care.
So at what point do you start thinking? So you graduate from high school, you kind of mess around, you have all these different kind of wacky jobs. At what point do you start thinking, hey, maybe I'll try comedy?
I've always kind of thought about it. you know, my dad's a magician, so I grew up around that. And so it was in, you know, it's always kind of in the back of my mind. And I always kind of wanted to do it. And then I was working at Reading Water Meters at that company in Mount Juliet. And my buddy, Michael Clay, that I worked with there, I had another friend that said that he wanted to go to Chicago, Second City. And I was like, oh, I kind of want to, like, do stand-up. So I just was like, you know, 23, got a job. I was like, oh, I can do that. And so I just agreed to move to Chicago. I saved that money then moved to Chicago and then started comedy. I mean, I started in Chicago. It was like 2000. I moved there in 2002. I started in 2003. But there's a lot of guys. Kumail Nanjiani started with me. Hannibal Buress, Pete Holmes. There was a lot of T.J. Miller, a lot of people in that Chicago scene that was all starting at the same time.
So when you go out and you do you move to Chicago and you're like, I'm going to get into comedy. How do you even go about making that decision? So I'm fascinated by that. So do you have to get accepted into like Second City? How do you show up? Is it just like anybody can show up and start taking comedy classes? I have no idea how that works.
Yeah, anybody can show up. The Second City, you could just, like, people that are also taking classes or people that just want to be better speakers, that's their job. It's like taking an improv class. So the Second City, you just, anybody can sign up. And then so I did that for, like, 8 weeks of it. And I didn't really like improv because it was, you're relying on too many people. Like, improv is, like, very, you know, you got to hope that everybody's funny. There's nothing funnier to me than someone that's not good at improv. Because the whole point of improv is you say yes and. So if someone's like, I went to the zoo, the next person should be like, oh, I was at the zoo too. Like, they got to keep it going. So then everybody can play off that stuff. And if someone's really bad at improv, it's beautiful. Because they go, someone will be like, oh, I went to the zoo. And they're like, yeah, the zoo was closed though. And you're like, well, now this whole thing's ruined because you just shut down the zoo. So I started, which is so funny to see. If you ever see bad improv, it's so funny. Just because it's usually one person out of the group that just doesn't get it. And but so I started there. I started taking classes, and then I did that. And I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to do stand-up. And I actually signed up for a class, like just a flyer that said, come learn how to do stand-up comedy. And I'm very pro-classes. Some comedians hate them. But they're not going to teach you how to be funny. Like, I think you have to learn that. But you just get around a group of people that are also starting, because it's very scary to start. I mean, you're by yourself. You're showing up to some bar, and you don't know anybody, and you're about to go in front of them and talk in a microphone and try to tell some jokes. So it's very, like, scary and very easy to, like, just turn around and be like, no, I don't want to do this at all.
So when's the first time you get up and actually tell a joke in front of a crowd?
2003. And I started taking the stand-up class the beginning of 2003. I have a VHS. My first three times on stage, I have a VHS of it. And, I mean, it's brutal, dude. It's I have, like, a chin beard. That was the thing that was done.
Oh, yeah.
You were rocking back then. You know. It's disgusting. I don't think I could even watch it.
How many people are in the crowd?
You know, your first time sometimes are pretty good because a lot of times you have friends come, and so they're rooting for you. So I worked at a restaurant in Chicago, and so I already had made some friends, and I told them I was doing it, so they came and watched. So your first time doing stand-up can sometimes be okay. And then it's the times after that gets real bad. That's when you get into jokes and nobody cares. And yeah, I mean, you're doing like 2-3 minutes. I used to have a open mic in Chicago called the Lion's Den, and it would start at I think 8 o'clock. You would sign up, and then they would be like a bucket, like just drawing names, and then they put a list up, and it would run from 8 to like 2 in the morning. And you wanted to get off stage around 10. That was like the sweet spot where like some regular people would come in. If you went on first or last, I mean, you're performing just for like 5 comedians.
And so you get up and you're trying to do like 2 or 3 minutes. So is that how long you went the first time that you did stand up?
Yeah, I believe it might have been 5 minutes, but it was 2 to 5. You're just doing that, and it feels like an eternity. I mean, right now where I'm at now, I mean, 5 minutes is not like it's not enough time. But at that point, when you first start, 5 minutes is, you know, if you had to stare at a wall for 5 minutes, you would see how long 5 minutes feels like. And so if you're talking to a group of people that are not laughing and just staring at you, it feels even longer. It's remarkable how crazy that, you know, what that feels like. And you just have a lot of different people. You see a lot of different comedians. There was guys that were, you know, you can see the guys that were good. You can see guys that have been doing open mics for 10 years that are nowhere. They know what they're doing. There's guys that would just play a ring to just, like, do, like, make fun of the comedy scene on stage. And those guys are very fun to watch, but you can tell, like, you're like, yeah, I want to be that guy. Like, that guy's going, no, you know, he's very funny here, but he's not going to be able to make someone that's not in this room laugh.
So you get up the first time in 2003, and you do a bit. What's your bit? Like, what's your joke that you're going for at that point? And how long did you craft what that joke would be? Like, how much time did you spend to have 3 to 5 minutes or whatever it was going to be the first time you got up on the stage?
I don't know the exact, like, how much time. I mean, you worked on it for a while, and you would just think of the jokes. I believe I can't remember if this is my first joke. One of it was about the rats in Chicago. We had rats in our apartment, and in Chicago, and they're bigger than squirrels.
Yeah,
you know, like, their rats are like it's another thing. So it was a joke about that, like, and then, like, giving the rat, like, a life, and just, you know, be like, we have these rats. He comes in, and I just wake up, and he's like, and he's got the refrigerator open, getting something to drink. And it was, you know, like, talking about that. And the other one was, like, about directions in Chicago. When I moved to Chicago, they would always tell you, if you asked for directions, someone would be like, you got to go south about 5 blocks. You got to go north about 8 blocks. And, you know, I was like, I don't know north and south. Like, I've never been told that ever. And then they would always tell you, well, the lake is east. And you're like, yeah, I can't see the lake, though. Like, I can't, but, you know, it's not.
It's so, I don't want to cut you off. That's so funny because my wife is from Michigan, and when she moved down to Nashville, she was always, well, like, am I going south? Am I going north? Am I going east? Or am I going west? I'm like, nobody talks like that. Like, you just say you're going to, like, this particular town, you know, like, or, you know, like, I'm going to this part of the city or whatever else. I don't know. Like, you know, she's like, well, when I'm getting off at this exit, am I going to go east or west? I'm like, I don't know. I've never thought about that in my entire life, north or south.
Never, like, talked about it.
I don't carry a compass around, but yeah, it's like something in the Midwest where everybody's they've all got compasses.
I always think of it when I hear traffic reports, when they're like, when they say south going on the 440, you're like, am I listening to the right town? Like, they're saying, they say where there's some traffic, and I'm like, where is this? What are they talking about? Because they just give, like, these references of, like, 440 between Briley and Donalds and Pike, and you're like, what? You're like, where is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, because all is all that.
So, and so you do that. And you're also, by the way, you said working in a restaurant at the same time. So then, are you trying to do everything in Chicago?
At the beginning I am. You know, when I was working there, it was during Bartman.
Oh, yeah.
The Bartman game. So I worked that night. And if you watch the Bartman, the 30 for 30 on Bartman, so when he left to go, you know, when he got escorted out and that girl had to, like, take him to her apartment. I worked with a girl that was her roommate.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Like, the next morning during that time, she comes back and tells us that when she got home, you know, we're watching all this on TV. This is before social media, but you would see it all on TV. And she came home, and the next day she's like, I walked in my door, and Bartman was just sitting in her living room.
That's
and
amazing.
She's like, yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, it's the craziest thing. It was just wild, like, you know, just to be like, she has no concept that he would be there.
Yeah.
And then he's just there. So I worked. So I was just working, you know, I was waiting tables during the day, some at night.
And then you would go do open mics, you know, once or twice a week. And then you start, like, just doing a little bit more, three, four, or five times. And then you start going out every single night. A big thing I watched, Comedian came out with Seinfeld. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, I've seen that.
It's on Netflix. It's unreal. And so I went and watched that in a theater by myself. And so right when I watched that, I was like, I need to move to New York. Like, that's where I need to be going. And so I was in Chicago for those 2 years, and then I moved to New York.
And so you moved to New York. Do you have a job at all, or you're 23, 24, 25 years old, I guess. What's your job when you moved to New York?
So when I moved to New York, I started barking where you handed out flyers to get people in this club. It's exactly like there's a HBO Crashing, a show on HBO with Pete Holmes. Pete Holmes got me barking at that comedy club. I did what that show showed. I barked at that Boston comedy club. And so you would do that all day. And what I did when I first went to New York, I started delivering. I worked for FedEx. And because I knew how to deliver. This was back when you had to read. You had to do it by a map. You would have to have a book. It's a map. And since I knew how to do that stuff, so a guy got me a job at FedEx. And so I started delivering. And I was like, I delivered in New York, just driving a FedEx truck up and down the streets of New York, Brooklyn, Queens.
You drove a FedEx truck in New York City?
Yeah. I was in one day we went to New Jersey, and it was more like how I'm used to delivering.
Yeah.
Where it was just regular houses. And I mean, I did so good. The guy was like, "This is the fastest I've ever seen." Like, I delivered faster than anybody they've ever had there. So I knew I had a good fallback plan because I was crushing it in FedEx. And so I got stuck in a snowstorm. And I mean, I remember being on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Brooklyn, and I have this truck, and I would try to go up a hill, and it was just this major snowstorm. And I just got spun sideways and then had to, like, slide all the way back down and then make it back to where the FedEx place to drop the truck off. And it was like a major snowstorm.
I would think that, so I've never known anybody to deliver, and we're talking to Nate Bargatze. This is Wins and Losses podcast. But what's the best thing that can happen on a delivery? Is it like you show up, you're a 25-year-old guy, and there's like a good-looking girl who comes to the door? Like, when you're a delivery guy, what is the best thing that can happen for you? Did anybody ever, like a good-looking person, a good-looking girl ever come to the door naked? Like, did you ever have exciting deliveries?
Not that I remember. I remember I delivered pizzas, too. That's how I saved money up before I moved to when I was in Mount Juliet.
Yep.
And the only thing I remember there, I remember going to someone's house, and they gave me money to go buy them beer. It was like adults that were like, we can't go drive.
They're drunk, yeah.
So you go to Kroger and like buy us some beer. And I went and bought them beer and brought it back, and they like gave me money. Like, that was the only, like, I'm trying to think, the only like kind of weird, obviously a very attractive lady would be your biggest hope, but I don't think we never had anything when I delivered mattresses. I've delivered everything. When I delivered mattresses, that was in Nashville. This is my buddy Jimmy Hunter. He owned Hunter's Delivery Service, and we delivered this one lady's house a refrigerator. We take her old refrigerator out, and there's a dead cat behind it. And she's like, "Oh, that's where that cat, that's where he went." She didn't know where he's been. She was like super old. And so then you're like, "Yeah, that's crazy, right?" You're just trying to talk to this old lady. Like, you're like, "All right."
Like, literally, like, how dead was the cat? Like, was it like,
dead.
Like skeleton, like or like,
it
like
it's. No.
And like she just didn't know. She didn't smell it. Like, she didn't know it was there.
No. I mean, she was just like senile.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like, it was, I mean, a very, you know, poor neighborhood.
Yeah.
It was in Nashville. Like, it was, and then we got caught in a drive-by right after that. This all sounds made up. We were driving, and then we were going back out, and then we hear like some pops. Sounds like fire trucks or firecrackers. Yeah. And we look, and this car behind us was like shooting up this house. And then they shot at our car, at our truck. We had like a 26-foot box truck. And they shot at it, and we swerved over, and then they drove by us and drove away.
Did your car get hit?
Yeah, we got hit. It went through the back of the back door and went out above where I was sitting.
So this is going to sound ridiculous because I've also been in a car in Nashville and gotten shot at and had the car get hit. So we were saying earlier, you're a class of 97 too. So
yeah.
For people who are from Nashville, this will probably make some sense at least. So I went to Martin Luther King Magnet High School in Nashville, and the cheerleaders at our high school, this was our senior year of high school, were having a sleepover. And so, I mean, it's probably, I mean, for guys out there now, you're like, that sounds awesome. I mean, when you're a senior in high school, the cheerleaders are all having a sleepover. So we decided we were going to roll the house, right? It's a house mm-hmm. in Antioch. And so it's me and like six of my buddies, and we're in two different cars. It might have been six or eight of us, right? All guys. And so we pull up at the house, and we've got toilet paper in our hands and everything else, and we're like throwing the toilet paper rolls all in the trees. And there are two cars. And my buddy, who would later be the best man at my wedding, he had an old Saab convertible, and he had put, like, it was awful car, but he had put, like, somehow he had decided to turn it into a shark. So it had, like, a shark fin on the top of it, and he parked his car back. It was a dead-end street. He parked his car fairly far back, and then there was another car full of people that was parked closer. So while we're rolling, all of a sudden we hear like a shotgun, like somebody clearly like cocks a gun and then fires into the air. And we're like, holy crap, what's going on? So we all panic and we all run, and a bunch of dudes get in the front car. And then me and my buddy Ian and my friend Paul, we all get into the back, his car. So there's like five people. It's probably eight of us. There's like five people who get in the front car. They drive away. They're fine. The guy who lived across the street from the head cheerleader has got a gun. And we dive in the back. We're in the back seat. My friend Ian is driving, and he has got his gun. And as we drive by his rifle, he takes aim at the car, and he fires once, aiming at the tire well, and he misses. But when the car gets hit, like, you can totally feel it. You know, like the car, I didn't mm-hmm. felt like to have a car get hit, but the car like jolts, right? And then as we pass him, he aims for the back window, and he barely misses. And just hits right below the back window. So there's this huge embedded bullet directly beneath it. And so the guy wow. later said, oh, I thought they were robbing the house. And I'm like, this guy, first of all, I don't think they did anything to this guy. But I'm like, he had toilet paper. This would be the worst yeah. robbery of all time if you're throwing toilet paper into the house, white toilet paper, so that everybody can see what you're doing. Like, the guy totally lied. I sometimes wonder what that guy does now and if he's still alive. But that happened to us in Antioch. And so we were, like, terrified. So maybe I'm lucky to be alive.
Wow.
But
so, yeah, I mean, listen.
I didn't know you worked as a delivery guy. So you're working as a delivery guy in Manhattan, FedEx guy.
Yeah.
And then are you up late at night going into comedy clubs? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, yeah. So I did that, and then I realized that, like, look, unless I want a strong FedEx career.
Yeah.
Like, this is – I was, like, sometimes working till 8, 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
Some days you get off at 2 in the afternoon, some days it's longer. So it was 2, I was like, I can't do this late. So then I switched to just loading trucks, which was like 5 a.m. And what I would do is we'd go in at like 7 p.m. I'd go into the city. I would hand out flyers for the shows that would start at like 8. And the show would run from 8 to 1, 2, I think 2 in the morning, maybe even 3 sometimes. And we would just stand out there and do that all night. And I would get to go up late at night, like one of the last spots. So you were lucky if there was 5 people in there. And then what I would do is I would just stay awake. Like, I would just stay up and go into FedEx at 5 a.m., work to 10 a.m., and then sleep during the day, and then start again at 7. And you did it every night because it was, you know, like, there's no nights off. That's what I'm here to do is stand up. And, I mean, that was like – I mean, this was during like Chappelle's show was going on. So Chappelle used to come in there. You know, it's like 2004. And, I mean, we'd just be standing outside, handing these flyers out, and Chappelle would just, like, pop in and go up, and there'd be 8 people in the crowd, and he would just on. I remember him having makeup on his ear, like behind his ear one day. He was, like, telling us about it. And it was, like – I don't know if it was it was like he was either painted like as a white person or he's doing some sketch, one of those sketches like that. And, but he would come in, we'd watch him go up in front of nobody and just sit there and, you know, talk and whatever. And then we'd go outside and say like Chappelle's on stage. And then, I mean, it would take 15 minutes and the room would be sold out because we'd let them in for free.
Yeah.
And we just make Chappelle's on stage. So then everybody would just come in. I'll never forget one couple. I said, Dave Chappelle's on stage. And they were like, I don't believe you. And I go, why would I make this up? Like, is that a comedy? I'm telling them, I'm like, why would I lie about this? And they're like, I think you're just trying to make us come in the room. I was like, go to that window, and if you do not see Dave Chappelle, turn around and leave. And they were like, no, and then just left. I always think about those people like, what? Like, you know, they literally, it's like, what do you think, we're trying to kill you? Like,
yeah.
It's a comedy club. He's a comedian. It's not that far off. It's actually perfect. It makes perfect sense that he would be there. I would get to sit and watch him, Bill Burr, Patrice O'Neill, another unbelievable comedian that passed away, Greg Giraud, I mean, Colin Quinn, like all of these people would just come in. They'd come in, like they would just stop in whenever, and they would go up, and then you would just, you know, you get to start meeting these guys and hanging around them. And that was like, you know, just kind of where you learn everything.
So when do you start thinking I'm decent at this?
There would be more, you know, you could have moments where, I mean, I remember the bad moments. The ones that I remember that hurt the most, I remember one time getting to ghost on a weekend, like the place would sell out. And so you'd get to go up on the late show. You'd get to do one spot on the late show. And I remember this crowd was so hot and so great. And this girl that went up that I knew that I didn't think was, I thought I was better than her. And she goes up and murders. And I was like, all right, if she's murdering, I'm going to just slaughter. Like, it'll be a problem. I go up and bomb the hardest you could bomb. I bombed so hard. Like, it was like, I never wore the shirt I had on ever again because I thought it was the shirt. I was just anything in my head I could make up. And I left. I had to go walk around like the West Village, like by myself. Like, I was like sick to my stomach. I was like, you know, where you just kind of have a moment of just like, I'm terrible. I don't know what's going on.
Why were you so bad? Why were you so bad then?
That night, you know, that I mean, I was never that, like, I bombed definitely. A lot of times it's situations when you bomb. It's, I mean, there's comics that are definitely terrible comedians. But if you have jokes and your jokes are funny, it's usually going to be a crowd problem. Like, it's usually like they're drunk. They're not, you know. I mean, there's a situation. One day I had to wait tables at that comedy club because the waiter didn't show up. So I was like, well, I knew how to wait tables. So I waited tables, and then I would go. Then I went on stage and, like, then came off stage and went to the table and was like, and brought them more beer.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's just a lot of, like, that situation is not good. No one's going to take you serious.
Yeah.
No one really takes you serious. You know, if I'm handing you a flyer trying to make you come into this show, and then you watch me on stage, you're not like, oh, wow, that's cool, man. Like, you're like, who is this?
You're not predisposed
loser?
To think this guy's good, which oftentimes can impact initial reaction. But on that particular night when you're out having your West Village walk of, like, shame, what happened that your jokes didn't work that night?
I think I got too cocky. Like, I got too, like, I thought if she did good, there's no way I can't do good. I'm better than her. And it was, like, too confident, too cocky. You may be walking up there with more of a swagger than I've earned. And, you know, a big thing for us is, like, if I see a comic sit down on a stool, I mean, like, it's a big no-no. Like, it's like, and if a comic does sit down, you better be unbelievable. Like, Bill Cosby sat down on a stool. So unless you're that level of comedian, you're like, you don't deserve to sit down on the stool. Like, because it gives a fake confidence. I hate fake confidence when people, like, you know, it's like it's not a real, they can just, they're like, I'm going to sit down and, you know, I don't know. It's very cocky. And I think I had that. I was very, I didn't sit down on a stool, but I'm like, there was like a mantle kind of behind you and people would lean on it. And I'm like leaning on it, like just very nonchalantly talking like I got everything. And I just, and then once like the first joke doesn't work, then it's like, I mean, now you're just like, you're struggling hard. You're like, oh. Even now, if I do comedy, if one joke doesn't work, you throw the next one out quicker and then quicker, you know, and then it's like, then they're like, what's going on? And then you never really get them back. And then you're just done. So, like, that night, that happened. I mean, everybody murdered except me. And, I mean, I got no laughs. So it just, like, destroyed me. I still remember it. Like, you know, like, it was like that. It affected me that much.
So that would have been at what age?
That was right 2004, 2005. So 23, 24, probably 25, 26, maybe.
When do you start being able to make a living off of touring and other things? Like, at what point do you say, okay, I've, you know, kind of served my apprenticeship? How much time do you put in doing the, you know, trying to get people to come into the comedy club and working full time doing another job? At what point do you kind of take that next step?
I would say, so I started in 2004. I mean, I got married in 2006. That helped because my wife was working in New York. She had a good job. So I was still doing like some like temp work where you would just, you know, I don't know, do whatever. You go like, I'd go to the convention center and just like ask me questions if you need help or something. So I remember still doing that. Like in 2006, 2007, I'd say 2008, I'm not really making it. I mean, I'm not making much money in 2008. I mean, you get to where, I just remember I wanted to get to where the amount of money I would make if I waited tables. You know, I just need to make like 20 grand a year. Like if I can get to 20 grand a year, like that's how much, you know, that was like a big deal. I was like, oh, wow, I'm making the same amount of money I was making waiting tables.
Right.
Like, you know, and you were like, that was like a big mark. And then you get, you know, then it just keeps, and then the mark kind of goes, the next year you might make 30. And then you remember, you know, you might make 50. And now you're like, oh, this is like a, like if I had a regular job, you're making what would be a regular person's salary. And like, you're just like, can't believe you're, you know, that's all you're doing. And so it's 2008 was like a big year for me. Like that was, I did Montreal Comedy Festival just for laughs. And they had a thing called New Faces. And that was, I did that. And then I did a Conan and Live at Gotham. So I did all of that in 2008. Live at Gotham is a little on Comedy Central where you do like 5 minutes. And then I did Late Night with Conan was my first time. Which
How
is very
nervous
funny
were
first
you
time.
For Conan?
I was very nervous. Like, so they came in. There's a couple stories with it. So the first time I go do it, I have these managers, and they're good guys. But they were like kind of crazy, like they're kind of lunatics. Like I would always say, like if you saw my manager, if someone walked into a room and you're like, "Who's your manager?" and I would be like, "Who do you think's about to get kicked out of here? That's my manager." Like he was a guy that he'd wear a cowboy hat and a handlebar mustache, and they're Jewish, and they just like he was just like kind of a redneck kind of Jewish person, and So I go, and first time I do Conan, I tell this in my act now, but like it's, I go do it. They pick me and my wife up at our house, and we go to 30 Rock. Right when we pull up to 30 Rock, all these paparazzi are taking pictures of the celebrities going into 30 Rock.
Yeah.
So they come into the car because they think, you know, I'm going to be some celebrity. And so then I open the door, and I open it. They all got their cameras up, and then one guy just goes, "It's nobody." Just yells it out, and they all turn and walk away from me, and it was just so like deflating to like, you know, I know I'm not acting like I'm somebody, but it's like you don't like in my head I'm like just delete the picture, you know, why do you got to shout it out, like just pretend to take it or something, like you know, but so that was the first time. So then I did Conan, and then a couple months later they were doing auditions again for Conan, like. And I told my managers, like, I want to try to do it again. And they were like, you can't do it again. Nobody does it within 3 months of each other. And I was like, well, I think I can try. Why not try? And they were like, no. These are out to dumb, these managers. They were like, no. So I go, so I just went and got it set up on my own. And I got it again. And I wasn't even going to tell them. I was at the point of just like, I want my managers just to see me on Conan again. Just to be like, yeah, I went and did it again because you can. And but they ended up finding out. They came to the audition, and then I got it, and then they came to Conan. And they're like, oh, that's cool, man. Glad, you know, they just played off.
So what's the benefit for people out there? We're talking to Nate Bargatze. I'm Clay Travis. It's Wins and Losses. What's the benefit for – and I'm just kind of fascinated by the comedic industry in general, but I think I'm kind of the average listener here. The benefit of doing a show like Conan is what? It's a legitimizing. It's a stamp of approval. It's the amount of people who are watching. Could you tell any difference in your career before and after you did Conan?
No, you don't. I mean, most people that do Conan for the first time go back to a day job.
Yeah.
Like they haven't made it. They're making, you know, you're struggling the whole time. the point of doing it, you have every time you think this could be the time. Like, you know, because when you used to do Carson, that changed those guys' lives.
Yes.
Like, they would back then, they would get a tour around the country, and they would, you know, if they're on it once, you know. But Steve Martin says it took him like 11 times on Carson. He said that in his book. So I always thought it was just like you did it once, but like, you know, a lot of guys, Seinfeld took off, Stephen Wright, he got asked back. That was when Carson waved him over, and he got asked back on the show the next week. That's how good he did. So that was like huge. But that was, there's three channels. So when I did Conan, you're doing it just to like, you hope it's going to be something crazy, but it's all just check marks in your career that like means you keep moving forward. So now I've done, I think, 13 late night sets, maybe 14, I don't know. But it was like, so it's like all of it is just like, you're just staying around, your face is on everything. You're going through the system of like trying to move up to a special. And like, so it's, that's what it, that's the huge benefit of it is that. I mean, like, when I did Conan, I mean, I wasn't even headlining. I don't know if I could have even done an hour worth of material. You know, you probably have like 30, 40 good minutes. So you just do it just to, it's a check mark. It's a good thing to get. You have a credit that helps you with, when I go try to play clubs in New York. Like, in clubs in New York, it's not like a typical, it's not like going to Zany's in Nashville or like, you know, an improv or something where you have one headliner and then they have an opener. Clubs in New York, there's like seven guys go on. So you have like, you know, every night is like seven comics are on every show and everybody's doing like 12 to 15 minutes. So those credits, like a Conan, helps you get into those clubs because now the club can be like, well, this guy was on Conan, you know, and no one knows that you're on. No one's like, oh, I know that guy, you know. But it's just, he's been on late night. So it, you know, reaffirms that we're a professional comedy club, you know.
So it's, I'm fascinated on the economics of this. So has comedy become like you're either a superstar and you make a good living, or it's like you can barely afford to make a living at all? Like there's almost no middle class of comedy. Would that be accurate or inaccurate?
I would say so. I mean, look, there's a, like, the problem with comedy is like the problem with, you know, probably what you do is like someone doing the podcast. Anybody can have a podcast.
Yeah.
So it's going to skew the numbers because like I can have a podcast, you know, like anybody on earth can do a podcast and no one listens. I mean, you see it all the time. I there's nothing greater to me than seeing comedians post videos to their fans and you'll see like four people like it. You're like, who are you talking to, dude?
Right.
Like it's insanity. But that guy says he's a comedian. So that guy's walking around saying he's a comedian. So there's way more of those people than there are that actually are doing it. But when you're in the meat of it, of the guys that are actually doing it, I think there's your Gaffigans, your Seinfelds, Sebastian. I think Sebastian Maniscalco, like these guys now, I mean, Gaffigan and Sebastian Maniscalco, Brian Regan, another one. But, like, they're guys that have made their livings from stand-up. Like, it's not their shows. It's not anything else. And they make crazy livings now. Like, they're on those Forbes lists. I mean, you know, they can make $15, $20 million a year, like, just touring. And if you can sell the tickets, then you can do these arenas. You can do these big things. So there is that – there is these guys that are making a ton of money. There's a lot of guys, though, that can make – under a million, make $200,000 a year. Like, you could do, like, I'm clean. So if you're a clean comedian and you say you just have some of the, if you don't have any of my specials, but I just have, like, my late night, my Tonight Show appearances, those are, like, check marks you have in your career. So I remember my career, at first, you're just, like, you want to get to where, like, no matter what, I could do cruises, I could do private gigs. Like, you know, I have enough credits where, you know, I could probably make $100,000 a year. Like, just, you just want to get to that point where you're just like, all right, I can do this now. You have like, it's like a safety net. You feel I have an hour worth of material that I can go do these gigs or whatever that, you know, you don't want to be doing, but they're good. You know, they're not bad gigs and guys can make a living. So there's a lot of guys in that, I would say can make 100 to $300,000-$400,000 a year, you know, and do pretty good. I mean, like, you know, and then there's another leap. And I think once you get above that, like, people are starting to leap into, like, where you know, I think you can be making, you know, you can make $1 million, $2 million, then you get, and then as you get up, it's like four or five, and you get Gaskin. I mean, some of them are making $30-40 million a year, and they're just touring.
So I'm curious on this. Can you tell the difference? I'll give you an example. Like, I feel like a lot of times with music, you can't really tell the difference between somebody who is the most talented musician. It might just be the person who gets the most marketing behind them and everything else. Do you feel like comedy is a meritocracy in that the guys who do the best and the girls tend to be the best comedians? Or when you guys sit around, like, you know, for instance, writing, there are a lot of great writers who don't make great livings because they're not writing for the masses. Do you think that the people who tend to make the best livings in comedy are the best at what they do, or they're comics, and you guys are like, man, this guy or this girl is incredible, but they just don't make, they never cross over? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like people in the craft that appreciate them in a way maybe that the masses don't.
Yes, I think a lot of, like, you know, a lot of guys, I mean, look, the top right now, Chappelle and Burr. Bill Burr, that Burr just had a special come out too. So there's your two top guys. And those guys, the thing that separates a lot of them is a point of view. Like, you get what their point of view is. And so when they have a point of view and they're talking to themselves, whatever they talk about is like their own thing. It's their own take on it. Everything's original. You want to know what they think about those things.
Yeah.
And so point of view is what separates. I'll do it a lot with myself. Like, I'll listen to, like, comedians, like, on the radio, like Sirius, you know, Netflix or Comedy Central Radio or Laugh USA or whatever. You're listening to all these, like, comedians. And I'll sometimes listen to guys and be like, why is that guy not famous? Like, that was a funny joke. Why is he not making any money? He's just, like, a dude that's just, like, plugging along, making 60 grand a year maybe. And it's like, it all comes from point of view. That's like the main thing to me that I see the difference is, like, everybody has to have a point of view. You have to have something. I mean, you're in a business that no one cares if you do stand up. No one needs you. No one's begging us to do stand up. We're trying to, you know, do something that's, you know, that no one's asked us to do. So you have to have something that makes people want to be like, I want to listen to this guy. So I think that's what separates those guys. I think there's no one that's terrible that's at the top. They could be not your cup of tea. You could not like what they do or that you don't enjoy it. But, you know, if you see people would always, you know, like Larry the Cable Guy. Like, I remember guys saying, like, oh, what about him? Like, you know, he's just doing Get Her Done and all these stuff. And they act like it's easy. And I would just, you know, all I would say is, like, then go do that. You go do it. If you can do that and make $60 million a year, then just why would you not go do that? But they can't, because he did create something. So, like, that's what's great, is he did create something. You might not like it. It might not be your thing, but it is a lot of people's things. Kevin Hart, he's created something. People love what he does. There's different guys, you know. To me, the best right now is Bill Burr and Chappelle. I mean, which is pretty clear, but that's the best between even comics. We all think those guys that's the best comics working. Gaffigan too. But then, yeah, there's plenty of people that are like, yeah, they're not like my thing, but there's a market for, look, that Hannah Gadsby, you know, she put that special out, whatever, you know, it's like, that's not, but she's not even doing comedy on it. Like, she's just like doing the, you know, but there's a huge market for it. People want to hear it. So she's doing something. She's like figured something out. So it's like, what you just sometimes have to, like, you got to take yourself out of it. Like, I'll say, I get why they are famous. Even if it's not someone that I like, I'll be like, I get it though. I get why people would like them. And that's like what I think those people have.
You mentioned Chappelle and Burr. You also mentioned that you're a quote unquote, you know, kind of clean comedian. So I'm going to come back to Chappelle and Burr because I've watched those comedy specials as well. But I want to come back to the decision. When and how do you decide, okay, I'm going to be a clean comedian? And for people out there, I'm assuming that means that you don't, like, tell off-color jokes. You don't really curse in your specials. Like, how do you make the decision that is going to be your avenue? Were you ever not a clean comedian? Did you try different personas, so to speak, before you found your voice? How did you come to do comedy the way that you do it?
I started, like, you know, I grew up here. So, I mean, that's all I was allowed to listen to. I mean, you grow up, you know, you're a Southern Baptist Christian family, just typical Nashville, you know, family. And so you just, I've never was allowed to, like, listen to any of this stuff. And so I just grew up, like, that's just how I grew up. And then, so when I started comedy, I knew I couldn't be dirty. And it's mainly because of my parents. I was like, my parents are going to, they would kill me if I was, like, filthy. And so that's been my thing ever since the beginning. I always say, like, what I've learned, this is something I've learned about myself recently. It's like, all the stuff that I write to not make my parents mad at me. Like, I don't want them to be embarrassed. So every joke is like, I'm writing to make them not be embarrassed or like they're going to be mad at me. And I think it helps because you're writing for something so specific that it then relates to a broader, instead of trying to, I'm not trying to like relate to everybody. I'm trying to not make them mad at me.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I started that way, and I was doing like midnight uncensored shows. Like that's how the shows were advertised. And everybody in the show was just filthy. And then I never had those jokes. I never had sex jokes. I just never did. But I learned that I would have to tell these jokes, and I didn't want the audience to be like, oh, this is a clean guy. So like I, you know, cause people just write you off when they're like, oh, you're a clean comedian. My thing that I like the most that people tell me is that they don't realize I'm clean.
Yeah.
And that's the ultimate goal, is like for you to be like, oh, I didn't even think about it. And
yeah.
Like that's what you want it. That's what you want to be, is, you know, to be like, yeah, they don't think about it. And I look at like, look, there's plenty of dirty guys. Whatever there's whatever you want, we can send you to someone that does that thing.
Yeah.
So there was plenty of people being dirty. So then once I started that way, then you're realizing like, well, I like not being dirty just because every single comedian is being dirty. So why would I put myself with them? Why would I, you know, if I talk about sex, they're all talking about sex, every one of them. So why would I want to try to write a better sex joke than the thousand of them that are out there? If I don't do that, then that's just one extra joke I have that is something different. That's something that no one's thought of.
So I want to go back to the Chappelle and the Burr. When you watch a special and you are in the same industry as those guys, I remember when I first started writing, people said you have to find your own voice. And it's an interesting dynamic because you want to find your voice, which sounds different than everybody else's voice, but also you're trying to learn simultaneously from the voices that surround you, right? In other words, for a writer, yeah, the best way to learn how to write is to read the people who are the best writers, and then hopefully you develop your own voice that builds upon whatever they have created. I'm assuming the same thing is true of comedians. Do you still kind of, you said you listen to the radio and you're talking about Burr and Chappelle and things like that. Do you find yourself taking notes, almost watching it like it's film? If you were an athlete, right? If you're a quarterback, you want to go watch what Tom Brady and Peyton Manning do because you can learn from them, because you do the same thing. You just don't necessarily do it quite as well. Do you watch comedy the same way as a young quarterback might watch game film?
Yeah, I watched Burr's special last night. And like, so I was with Burr like a year ago or something, maybe a year and a half ago. Like we went to Talladega. And so I've done Daytona and Talladega with him. And like, so I got to see some of this, like whenever he was like first starting to put it together. And what you take from, look, when you first start, the biggest thing you take is you take people's cadences. So that's the thing that you get influenced with the most.
The speech patterns.
Like the speech pattern. The thing that makes them laugh. There's like Brian Regan's is, you know, whatever he is, you know, his thing that he has that makes people laugh. Burr is like, you know, Burr has his arm on the mic stand. He props up and puts his arm. So you would start seeing every younger comic starting to do that. And they grab the mic stand and they start moving it a little bit more. Chappelle hits the microphone on his leg. I mean, I hate it that he does it, but that's like what he does. And you can start seeing some other guys do it. Like, and you start seeing it. And like, so when you first start, everybody in New York, everybody sounded like Dave Attell. Dave Attell was probably pound for pound the funniest comedian that's ever lived. Truth, like if I had to pay to watch someone, I'd watch him, because there'd be nothing's more fun than watching him. And so Attell was like, everybody sounded like Attell. Everybody just, you would, you know, like if you went and watched him, you just, you would start, you know, you start taking the cadence from him because they, you got to learn a cadence that makes people laugh. So the way they can talk is like the way they say something is like they just figured something out and it's their thing. So you start like you get influenced by it very heavily and you have to be very aware of it. Like you have to like, you know, you would realize that like there's times where I was like, oh, I can't go watch Dave Attell anymore because I feel like I'm sounding like him or Burr or like whoever. Chappelle, like you just
it's like every like, oh, every it. Young Southern novelist sounds for a while like William Faulkner, right? Because they're like, yeah. Oh, this is the guy who's got the most pronounced voice that kind of defines a region. And you grow up reading him or whatever else. And so everybody has a Faulknerian twist. And for you, it would be that guy that you're talking about right now, where everybody mimics him because he's literally the master of the craft.
Yeah, yeah. Dave Attell. Have you heard of Dave Attell?
No.
Insomniac on Comedy Central. He's unreal, dude. So just very jokes, very quick, whatever. Yes, but you catch yourself doing that. So you have to like learn to like sometimes get – you still need to be watching them because you need to see – you know, that was the big thing about moving to New York is like I would see people make it. I remember Aziz Ansari getting passed at the Comedy Cellar. Passed means he's allowed to play there. And I was doing open mics with him. And then he's like, now he's playing at the Comedy Cellar. And then he was hosting the MTV Movie Awards. And you're like, what? So, like, you need,
it happened
to,
really
you need
fast.
To be around. It happened very fast. And you need to see that. I saw Bill Burr, like, Burr's almost entire – he was probably a 10-year comic when I moved to New York. And he was unbelievable. And so I watched him go from that comic to the comic he is right now. And so I've seen Burr is like my guy. Like that's the guy that like I couldn't believe when I first saw him. I went to his HBO One Night Stand taping, and I mean he murdered so hard you could feel the crowd like be like you know like they were like what was that like what happened like because they were laughing so hard and you were just like you just knew like oh this is it's happening right now. This dude's about to shoot off on a rocket and become the guy that he is right now. And so it was very neat to, like, see that stuff. But, yes, you have – so now when I watch it now, I will sometimes watch old Burr specials. But I'll do it to get motivated. Like, I'll do it – I get very excited when I hear a joke, like, really working and a joke that's really funny. It gets you, like, all juiced up and you're excited and you're like, yeah, yeah, I want to create something like that. So you're not doing it to, like, learn – I'm not, you know, now I wouldn't – like, what I would learn from – like I opened for Chris Rock. And, like, so I would just learn from Chris, like – you know, some of it's just even how to be Chris Rock. Like, you know, some of it's, you know, it's like, how do you tour? What do you do, like, on the road? And, like, you know, seeing how they, you know, when you do theaters, like, you could just be asking them, like, do you do an encore? How do people come out? Not that I'm at that level that those guys are at. But, you know, you're just, like, asking them, like, some little questions like that. But if I watch their special, a lot of it is motivation. Like, it's just to, like, get you up and writing and like get you excited again about like stand up.
So when is the first time? So you get married and obviously your wife, you probably can give a shout out here, has to be pretty supportive, I would imagine.
Lauren. Oh yeah.
When do you start thinking, hey, like I'm so the career trajectory is you get on Conan, you pull up and people have no idea who you are. But you keep plugging away. I mean, you're talking years now, and you said initially your goal is to make $20,000 a year, and you know, you're putting in years to be able to get to $20,000 a year. And obviously this podcast is called Wins and Losses, and we're talking to Nate Bargatze, but you got to get years in to get to there. And that's what I say from a writing perspective. I had to put in years before I made anything, right? Writing online. I just had to grind and grind and grind. And I feel like there's this idea that you're going to be instantaneously successful. It really doesn't happen like that for most people in comedy.
No, it doesn't happen. It takes them all. I mean, Burr, Louis C.K., you know, some guys, I think a lot of times it's either people make it like very young or like they're 40. And like that's just what happens. That's when they make it. Like, so, you know, I remember Burr telling me something a long time ago, like some advice. Like he saw me And this was one of the first times he saw me do stand up. I mean, this was like, you know, I'm friends with Burr now, like, but like this was a long, it was a big deal when he like knew my name, and you're like, you can't believe, you know, he knows you. And I remember he's like, just keep doing it, man. He's like, look, it takes comics like us a lot longer, but when you get fans, you get them for life. And it was just like that advice of just like, yeah, you got to keep doing this. But when you get new fans, they will stay with you. Like you're not a flash in the pan. You're not getting people that are not invested in you. You're getting fans, people that are discovering you. And then like, I know it now when my live show, I say that there's a lot of, right when I start, I go, look, there's a lot of pressure on me for this show to be good. But I know there's a lot of pressure on a lot of you because I know a lot of people introduce my comedy to their friends and yeah. bring them to the shows. So this needs to go as good as for you as it is, it does for me. Or you're never going to suggest anything in that friendship ever again.
That's actually really good. Yeah.
And then, yeah. And I say, I was like, they're really like, oh, you heard about a new restaurant. You're like, oh, is it Nate Borghetti good? I think we'll pass. So it's like, that's, you know, but it's like, I know that these people are invested. Like, so when they come and they're fans of you, like a lot of them have been, I mean, I've got some people that have been there since 2008. And like they saw me on Live at Gotham, and then they, you know, and then it slowly just gets bigger and bigger, and you just get people that like, you know how do you? I mean, you probably know, like you get fans. You know, sometimes when your fans become your friends because like you can't believe that someone even likes what you do,
yeah.
And then you end up like talking to these people. Like you're like, oh, now I like know them, like because they talked to me when nobody knew who I was, and then you end up like just kind of knowing them in your life. So it's like you just, you know, you slowly just get these people and they become way more invested because you're not, you know, Seinfeld. You're not like a Walmart or a Target. You're not just this gigantic thing. You're, you know, it's, I don't know, people are really rooting for you. And that's what I've learned is that you want people to root for you.
And so as people are rooting for you, you also then have some awful, I'm sure, times. Like I talk about from a writing perspective, the worst thing that can happen to you for a writer is you have a book signing and nobody shows up, right? And I think yeah. every single writer has had that opportunity happen, right? Where you show up and, you know, you like I tell this and I've talked about it before. Like I had when I did Dixieland Delight, my first book, I drove down to Birmingham. I had a signing at a Books A Million on the north side of Birmingham. And I showed up there and not one person bought a book and not one person showed up. Right. And I love that too, by the way. I would
have paid good money to just sit and watch you sit there
for 2 hours at a Birmingham area. I mean, I did a book signing.
Everybody
at Walmart.
That walks in, you're like, hey, how you doing? Like,
yeah.
Hey,
yeah. They're like,
over.
And by the way, I wrote a book about SEC football in Birmingham, which is like the most hardcore market imaginable, right? For college football. It's not like I was trying to sell, you know, like something that the market had no interest in. And I did like book signings at Walmart. Like, not even, I tell people, not even the good Walmart. Like, there's good Walmarts if you are familiar with neighborhoods. Like, there's like, oh, that's the good Walmart, right? Like, I did bad Walmarts in Knoxville. And, you know, like, there's this, like, fat people with, you know, carts full of Diet Dr. Pepper. And you're like, hey, are you interested in reading, you know, a book, too? And you're just, I mean, you're there for, like, an hour. You don't want to leave because, like, you know, I don't want to look like a diva. But you're just like, I mean, this is a long time to be here, right? And so I'm sure for comedians, you guys all have experiences like that too, right? Where you show up and like there's nobody there or there's like one or two people and you're like, you just want to sit at the table. I'll tell you my routine, you know, like we'll let you have a beer.
Oh,
like,
yeah. I had that Caroline's on Broadway. They was doing my first headlining thing they gave me. They would do these like they would give like the New York comics, like the guys that were kind of coming up. They give us like a Wednesday night. And it'd be like, we get a headline. Nate Borghetti, I get a poster outside of Caroline's on Broadway.
Huge deal for you,
a big club. Huge deal. And you're like, I can't believe this is happening. And so I go downstairs, and they told me and the audience that they don't have enough people and canceled the show. They told us all together.
Oh,
like
my God.
Like, I was just in the bar, and they're like, there's no show. And I just have to walk out with these people. So you would get, I mean, I would say I performed for one guy once. He wouldn't leave. And I asked him to leave in the microphone and he said no. And then, you would get two people, three people, four. I mean, at the beginning, six, you were like, this is all starting to come together. It's happening.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And that's why New York comics are the best. Because you have, I mean, it's a hard 3 to 4 years of just, you know, because when they would run shows, they would be, you would run a show, like you'd just be in a basement and it'd be like 8 o'clock. And if you got two people to go down there, be free. And if you got two people to go down there and then someone would be like, hey, they're about to leave. And then you're like, well, then someone's got to go up. And so someone would go on stage for those two people. And then you would, then other people would be out front trying to get more people down there. You're just trying to get something started so we can get a show. So, yeah, you're regularly performing in front of, I mean, and you do gigs like where you would, I mean, you'd be at a sports bar and they would like not cut the TVs off.
Yeah.
And you would, you know, just the TVs are on like over your head and people don't even know a show is happening. I mean, this is, and it's just the norm. Like you just get there and then they tell you like, I don't know, last week was packed. I don't know what happened this week. They always tell you right. that. Yeah. It's always the week before was like the greatest show they've ever had. And now it's the worst show. I remember doing a show once at some Italian restaurant and the stage was in the middle behind the bar. But when you stood up, no one could see you because of the wine glasses. So no one could see your head. So you would have to just like, you would have to, and there's no chair. So you'd have to like just bend over and like talk to this crowd that, you know, and no one's invested. One show was in the people were in two different rooms and you just stood in the middle. So they couldn't, but like you, when you're doing that, it feels like you're performing for your two different audiences. No one's laughing at the same times. It's right. very weird. And you just, and I mean, you do that all the time. And like, you would do it for like free food. Like they're like, we're going to pay you, we're going to give you free food. And you would drive out there, you know, and spend all this gas money or whatever you're spending. You're just making no money. I just remember it was like, that's why the one thing good with comedy is that it was never about the money for me. Because if it was, I would have never made it to this point. Because you just can't have it be about the money at the beginning. Because you're going to lose money. You're going to just lose a ton of money. So if you're not taking gigs because of money, then you're not getting up enough. So I just remembered, like, you know, when you would get paid $20, if someone didn't pay me, I would just remember thinking, like, this, if this $20 matters to me this much, like, then I'm doing something. I shouldn't even be doing this. Like, if I'm like, dude, I need this $20. Like, you just keep a day job until you don't have to. That's basically all you do.
So how close did you ever come to quitting? How many, were there times where you were like, this is just not going to happen for me? Or at least maybe not quitting, but like, I've got to focus on something else. I got to have a different career goal.
I never thought I was going to quit. I remember my wife and we only had one conversation. She was like, how long would you do this if it, before it worked? I mean, cause it is, it's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years.
Yeah.
You're not making any money. But I told her, I was like, I'm not going to quit. I was like, I'm going to do this forever. So, you know, that's what I always tell young comedians. Like, if you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, if someone's like, you know, how long are you going to do it? Like, you know, you need to be like, look, this is what's happening. So you're either on board or you can leave. But like, I'm not quitting this for you. Like, you have to dive in that much. And you have to be like that upfront about it. You just have to straight up, you know, so many dudes, they get in relationships and they're like, my girl wants me to hang out on Monday, you know? And it was like ridiculous to me that it was like, what are you talking about? Like, you don't like, you know, sit there and be like, oh, that's cool. So you can't go out to the show on Monday because your girl wants to watch The Bachelor or something. Like, you're like, it's insanity. Like, you have to go out. So you have to just always like do that. The only thing I would have done that was crazy, my buddy, I remember for money, he went to, this was in like, I want to say 2008 was my year that was good. He went to Iraq and did like, he was a contractor where you would like, he worked in like the Camp Liberty or something. And they were just like checking people in and out. And it was like one of these gigs that you go over there for like 8 months and you can make like $100,000 or something. I don't remember what it was, but it was something like that. And they just, you go work there and then you come back. And I almost did that. Because I thought if I could go there for 8 months, make $100,000, I could come back and then I wouldn't have to have a day job. And yeah. I'll just, you know, but I ended up not doing it, which I'm glad I didn't. Because, you know, you don't need to take yourself out of something too when you're in it. That was the only time I ever did something.
When did you file taxes and you were like, wow, I had a really good year? Was there a dollar figure as a comedian where you were like, boom, check this out?
I remember 50. I remember making 50.
Yeah, 50 is a big number.
And
yeah.
50 was a big number. And I remember 20, too. I remember like 20. I remember 20. I remember 50. Then it's like 60, you know. And then like, you know, and then you get to the point when you, I mean, like, you know, I talk all about my, like when you get to, you do an LLC, like when you get to that
right.
point. And then you're like, that's insane. Like, you think you, all you want is like, you're like, I just want to get, like, I got to make up a name that people have to write these checks to me. And like, you know, and so you get to that point where you do it. So it all just starts getting like, where it gets more and more. And then you have no concept of like, I have no, you know, money. Like, I have no concept of any of this money, like, or like how to, what to do, like, or anything. So it's all like new. But it's like, yeah, I would say it was like 50. I remember making 50 and then 60, you know, and then getting to like 60. And I always just made these jumps. And then, you know, where you're like, oh man, I have like a regular job. Like you're like, you know, you can go eat, you take a cab home instead of taking the train. And then, you know, and then it all just kind of keeps, you hope it just keeps building from there. You make like 100, you're like, oh my God, this is like the richest person alive. You know, it feels how many, very earned.
How many days a year are you on the road as your career starts developing?
Now, when I was in New York, I stayed in New York. And then I moved to L.A. I moved to L.A. out to this, I don't know about money, but this is my advice. The best advice I ever read, Jerry Weintraub had a great book. He was Elvis's manager and then became a big producer, produced Ocean's 11, all this stuff. He has a great book. And the best advice that I've ever heard was I remember in his book, he said he knew any time he was starting to feel comfortable, it was time to make a change. And I have, like, lived my life by that. When I heard that, I moved to Los Angeles 2 months after I read that because I knew that I was comfortable. I knew, like, I was in New York. I was getting up at all the clubs. I was not, like, chasing anything in New York anymore. I was doing late-night spots. You know, I could be making like, I was making probably like around 60 grand a year or something like that. You know, where you're like, all right, I got a living and all this. And I knew that if I stay here, next thing I know, I'm going to be 50 calling in avails, you know, trying to make $1,000 a week if I'm lucky. And so I knew at that point, I was like, I need to go to Los Angeles and put myself in a situation that I'm not comfortable with, that then is going to make me like, you know, have to like work like now, you know, like there, I was like settled. I was like, I went up every single night. I wasn't fighting for these spots. I wasn't having to hang out. And then I moved to LA and then nobody knows me. And I'm back to, you know, you're not at square one, but you're starting, you're lower than what you just left from. And then you're, you know, you got to go back. Well, and what was the other thing? What did you say other than that?
I don't even remember now because I got so enraptured with the idea of once you get comfortable, you gotta shake yourself up.
It's the best. The best of advice I've ever heard, man. It's true, literally in everything that I've ever done. If I start feeling comfortable, I mix it up, and you do that until you're, you know, I mean, you really should never be comfortable. You should always be like, oh, I need to go to another thing, and I'm starting to tour now, and like, so now these people are coming, and then it's like doing this show that I just did, that TV show. Like, it's like doing that. That was like a very thing that was uncomfortable, like that made me uncomfortable. And like, you know,
can we talk about that?
Going. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So first of all, when did we? I came and watched your act, and I'm trying to think of when it was. I think we had you on the radio show that I did in Nashville, right, a couple of times back in the day.
Back in the day, 104.5. You came with me to Third Man Records at the UFC Nashville event.
That's right.
I was
That's
in
right.
town, and I saw
and my
you
wife
UFC
and I were
thing.
Out, and we were like, yes. We were trying to decide what we were going to do, and we
it
just
was
ran
early in the fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, hey, we're going to do a show. We were doing a recording at Third Man Records. And so I was like, we're going over there. We took a golf cart and drove over to Third Man.
And
you absolutely, like,
you absolutely killed it. You were telling the story about going to the North Carolina, like the guy's house or whatever. Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you absolutely killed it. Like, I mean, that's a tiny, I don't know, 100 people there maybe in Third Man Records, like in their back room?
Yeah.
which was really cool. And so we saw that in person. And then we stayed in touch for a little while, you know, texting back and forth and everything else. Because you're a big, we haven't even mentioned this, but you're a huge Vanderbilt sports fan, right? I mean, for people out there who don't know, like, how big of a Vanderbilt fan are you?
I grew up watching Vanderbilt. My cousin Ronnie Borghetti coached at Vanderbilt in the basketball in the 70s. And then was the color commentator forever. So we just grew up around Vanderbilt. And my mom worked in the ticket office. And I've been – my Vol State, my one experience – the only thing I did good at Vol State, I gave a speech about Vanderbilt's 1996 football season where we won five games. And I had a highlight reel of those games. And it was – and I just talked – I knew every player. My favorite player at Vanderbilt was Corey Chavis. And then so every – I knew every player at that point. And I'm like just talking about Vanderbilt. And I just remember I was like very passionate about it. And it's like something I think back now with comedy. Like you learn that like, oh, when you're really passionate, like then that's when people want to hear. Because they're like, this dude's way into this. So like I'll listen to – you listen to anybody if they care.
Yeah.
And so like I remember just giving this speech. I showed like some of the highlight thing. And then it showed up to that LSU game where we got – that was the year of the LSU, Vandy LSU where we had two delay of game penalties trying to go for two. And then we got an extra point blocked and lost to LSU.
Which is, by the way, like the story of Vanderbilt football in a nutshell.
Oh,
now,
God,
now it's actually
so
the story
good.
Of Tennessee football
Woody
in
ball.
A nutshell. Yeah.
That was Woody
Ball. Oh, I remember. I've watched all these games over the years. I mean, we're the same
age. Have fun, expect to win.
Yeah, that was a great slogan.
Yeah. It's such a good slogan.
Have
like,
fun,
hey, let's
expect
just have a good
to
time,
win.
Right?
And then, by the way, Woody Woodenhofer ended up working I hope he's still alive, but he was working on the Destin Toll Bridge in Florida. Do you remember that?
Oh, wow. You know what? That does sound very
My co-host on 3HL back in the day, we were going down to do the SEC spring meetings. And he's like, Brent Doherty, and he's like, we met up, and he was like, dude, you're not going to believe this. He's like, I just drove over the toll bridge, and I looked down, the guy's got like a world, you know, like a Super Bowl ring, and it's Woody Woodenhofer, who used to be the head coach of Vanderbilt, and he's now working in the toll booth at Destin. Like, I mean, but have fun, expect to win.
Did you tell him that? That's what you should have told him when you paid him the toll.
Oh.
All right, I mean, Woody, have fun, expect to win.
What an amazing
and give him
slogan.
Two quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but there can't be anybody else who's ever won a Super Bowl that's worked at a toll booth before. But, I mean, literally he had a Super Bowl ring on working in the toll booth one day.
That's
but it was
awesome.
SEC, a head SEC football coach. He was like, yeah, I just like this job. You go to, like, Memorial Gym? You would go to all these different Vanderbilt athletic events when you were a kid?
Yeah, we used to be to go on Vanderbilt's football field, like you could just walk on it.
Yeah.
I remember going on it and like playing football with like my parents.
Yeah.
You know, when we were really young, like they never had it locked up. So I mean, I would go, I mean, I was basketball, Drew Maddox, you know, I mean, Drew Maddox probably around our age, a little bit older, but like, you know, seeing all them, Ron Mercer, when he was going to maybe go to Vandy, I asked him actually, I golfed with him. And I mean, I told my buddy when we were going to go, Adam Son, another guy that played basketball at Belmont, and I grew up with him. And so I told him, Ron Mercer, I go, how long do you think it'll take before I ask Ron Mercer how close he was to go to Vandy?
Yeah.
And I didn't make it off the range. And I mean, literally, maybe the second sentence I said to Ron Mercer was like, "Were you going to go to Vanderbilt?" And he said, "No." He said he never was going to go to Vanderbilt.
Because
I've like made up
who-
this.
Yeah, for people who don't know out there, Ron Mercer is one of the greatest Nashville area basketball players of all time. And obviously he became a lottery pick, went to Kentucky, won a national championship. And Vanderbilt, their board of admissions, refused to admit him. And it was a huge story in Nashville. And the idea was, oh, he was going to go there because he was friends with Drew Maddox. They played together at a high school locally, Good Pasture High School. And they were going to go together, and it was going to be like the greatest tandem ever. Vanderbilt basketball was going to be incredibly relevant. And they didn't let him in. And so you asked him. I've never heard him. Like, he said he was never going to go.
He said he never was going to go. I mean, maybe they didn't let him in, but, like, he said he was never going to go to Vanderbilt.
He went to Kentucky,
like,
instead.
Kentucky.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the top high school player in the country. Like, I mean, it was going to be very insane. It's like Darius Garland actually went to Vanderbilt. Like, you know, but he was that high of a level of a player, so it made complete sense.
I mean, I went and watched him play in high school, and in high school basketball, he was as good of a high school basketball player as you could possibly be. Like, you went and watched him play, and it was like watching, I'm trying to think of an equivalent outside of the world of sports. I mean, he was LeBron for Nashville, right? I mean, like, that's how good he was in high school. You watched him, and even if you didn't know anything about basketball, somebody could watch for like 5 minutes and be like, oh my God, that guy is so much better than everybody else.
Yeah, that guy's the real deal.
And so you grew up a Vanderbilt fan, and so the reason I'm bringing up the Vanderbilt thing is I'm circling back around. So when we were finishing Lock It In Season 1, there is a hotel, the Intercontinental Hotel, on Avenue of the Stars in Los Angeles that overlooks the Fox lot. And so I was sitting at the bar there talking to, I think, the Fox Bet people who are now, you know, running the betting universe, and I see you walking in, and you were checking in for how many days at that hotel? You went to,
5-0.
Went to the front desk, because I've spent months at that hotel, maybe years of my life now, because working at Fox, like, you're right there, you can just walk back and forth. And you checked in, and they were like, oh, we've got you here for 50 days, Mr. Bargatze.
Yeah. And yeah, the lady said it's the longest she's ever checked in.
Yeah.
Because she's never seen that. I think she was newer.
Yeah, 50 days. So, then we hang out for a little bit, and I've stayed there so many times. Like, I was like, hey, you need to check out the room that I always stay in. It's got this sun deck. Like, I'm giving you tips because you're going to be there for 50 days.
Yeah, because I'll be there 50 days.
We leave, finish shooting Season 1 of Lock It In. Then we get like 6 weeks off. We come back to start the second season, and you're still at the same hotel. And while you're there, you've been doing this pilot, the Nate Bargatze Show, which they're filming on the Fox lot. It's with Disney, because Disney now controls a lot of the Fox lot because of the asset purchase and everything else. And so you're like, hey, come by and check out the set. And I got to say, the set is unbelievable. It's set in Nashville. And, I mean, there's a zany stage, but all the detail, like, I was blown away. They basically built a Nashville house on this L.A. soundstage, and we're walking around, and all the details, like, there's a flyer for Titans tickets. There's, like, the mayoral election was about to happen in Nashville. Like, every detail is so incredible. I mean, my mind was blown by it.
Yeah, it was, it's how much detail they, you know, the people that put all that together. They're just, it's like what they do. And like, you know, I remember them talking to me about the house and like, what do we want the house? Because the show is basically like an Everybody Loves Raymond. So it's like every, you know, we have the parents from that 70s show. The wife is Katie Azleton. She was on The League. And so like, they made us like, when we were designing the house, it was like, how do you want to design? Like, you know, what's Nashville? Like, it's all this stuff that you're like, well, I don't know, you know, what stands out, you know? But you slowly start, I wanted an island, and I remember I wanted to come like the garage. I'd go, everybody enters through the garage in Nashville. Like, there are a lot of people, your garage doors are open always. And, they, you know, just this incredible detail. The lighting guy, he grew up in the South, but he made the lighting look like Nashville lighting, where it's humid and hot and it's just like thicker. So like the air is thicker. So the lighting, like the sunlight looks different than it would in California. So they make it all look like this crazy, they're just such a different thing. And I mean, it feels like it's a real home, you know?
And so you're out there for all this time working on this show, and then you guys eventually do a version of the show, like you tape a pilot. And, I mean, it's amazing, like, how detailed it is and how everything is put together. And has there been any, like, you're sitting around now waiting to hear, have you heard of any verdict on what the pilot looks like, or has it been put fully together yet?
Yeah, I've seen it. So we're editing it and putting it all together now. So I watched it a few times, and then we turn it in shortly in a week or two or something like that, and then we give it to ABC, and then it's kind of out of our hands.
So
then,
it's like, it's 23 minutes. How many hours do you think you worked to put together one 23-minute pilot?
Well, it was those 50. I mean, every day you were doing something for those 50 days. Yeah. I mean, I've been, you know, we started selling the show 2 years ago. So this show has been around for 2 years and has been told no twice. And then we got very stuck in the Fox-Disney merger.
Yeah.
And because we were at Fox originally, then we went to ABC. And then it got told no again. And then my special came out and, like, just some other stuff happened. And then they were like, oh, let's try it again. And so you're working on it the whole time. It changes. I mean, we had casting. Casting took like 2 months. And I'm in all the casting things. I'm like, you know, on who you're going to get. It's every single day of your life. You're just like, just absorbing and taking all this stuff in. And then when you start writing, I mean, you're in the writer's room and you're in there for, you know, you could be in there for 10 hours and you're just, you know, and you write a script. I mean, how many times you change a script is, that's the thing that I'm most like always blown away. Cause when you first write it, you think like, this is it. This, you know, like Seinfeld, like when George Sanchez is like, this is the show. That's how you feel. Like, you're just like, this is it. It's perfect. And then it just changes 30 times.
Yeah.
And you're blown away by, you know, because you think it's good. And then the next day you're like, this is maybe the one, this is unwatchable. It's so bad. And then you just go through these big extremes.
Yeah.
And like, you know, as a comedian, you want to put in jokes, but jokes just don't matter. They don't matter at the beginning. Like, the story really matters. So the jokes, like, you're, and then when we tape, because we do it in front of a live audience, the night we taped, they're giving you jokes then. Like, if a joke doesn't really land, then they come and say, like, well, say this now, and you change it up, and like, you just kind of change it up on the fly. And, you know, and I'd never done acting at this, so I mean, I was doing a meeting with an acting coach, like, you know, 4 to 10 hours a week, whatever I could do. And we would just like work on stuff. I had a dialect coach there, because you know, with Southern people, like we don't say words correctly. I really don't, and I mumble. So you know, he would like work with me. So they like how to say something like will, like I was like if you say we will be right back, we're like we'll be right back.
Yeah,
and we tend to like throw an R in there because the South doesn't really like use their jaw. And so we would spell it on my script, W-I-L-L, and I would just say, we'll be right back. And if I said it like that, it sounded correctly. So we would go through and, like, you know, put those just to make sure I'm saying, because I'm not trying to get rid of my accent, but, you know, some stuff, they're like, no one knows what you're saying, dude. Like, no one can understand it. And so, yeah, it was, I mean, it was every day. It was like, you'd go in at like 7 a.m. and I would go back to the hotel at 1 a.m. and you just did that for a week. Cause I was writing too. If you're acting, you're usually done about 4 and then you go back the next day.
So like, I mean, it's basically like, I don't know, show production boot camp. I mean, is that a good way to describe it? I mean, because you're basically just going back and forth the whole time and you're putting in these hundreds of hours and then you'll put together a finished product. And then if they say yes, boom, you got to do how many shows? Like you just, I mean, as soon
well,
as they
you
say
won't
yes,
know. I mean, that's,
yeah.
Yeah, you do. I mean, it could be 3, it could be 6, 13, 13 is probably the most. And then, so you just see what they want to order. I mean, so much of it plays to like where you would be placed on in ABC's lineup. There's a million different ways that different directions that this can go. But yeah, you learn a lot of stuff. I mean, like I learned, you know, like with TV, you just learn how like specific. I mean, you got to be careful when you say stuff. Cause I would say if I said something, I said I wanted a refrigerator a certain way in the parents' house. And then the refrigerator is there. Then you're like, I don't like that refrigerator. I want it a different way. And then they're like, you know, but like if you just even say that in passing, they go
somebody's
get
there doing it.
Like,
yeah,
someone's doing it. And then you're like, oh, I got to make sure when I say something, I really want it, because like there's people here that will do that. They will get that and they'll get you whatever, you know, their job is to make sure that this house is believable. And, you know, I mean, they had newspapers from that were Williamson County or Davidson County newspapers.
Yeah.
Like on the tables. So you would just know that, you know, so it just, so everybody like gets in the mood of, you know, what the show is.
So
that it's Nashville.
You're also a really unassuming, you know, like I would say totally normal guy. I like to think that that also defines the way that I kind of carry myself. Right. I think Nashville in some way.
Well, I don't No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
I think Nashville in some way maybe is – I mean, you're born and raised here. I was too. I think maybe it's a city that doesn't really kind of – It's I don't know, maybe it's different now for kids who are growing up now, but it seems like a city where, you know, like putting on airs is not really a thing people do. And so I think it tends to be a very normal, like middle of the road kind of place, at least in the era that we grew up in. And I know when I walked on that Fox lot for the first time, I was like, holy hell, like what in the world am I doing being here? And I'm on the Fox lot, you know, like doing our television shows or whatever else. I can't even imagine when they build a version of the house that I live in Nashville and the entire show is built around me. Like, that has to just be a mind-blowing experience, right? It can't possibly feel real. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. I mean, like, it feels – I mean, you know, I try to never make anything lost on me. I try to, you know, you just be nice to everybody and you appreciate it and you – You know, I mean, you just kind of like, yeah, you give off. I don't want anybody to think that they can't come talk to me. Like, you know,
yeah, right.
Because in that world, they can. Like, that world, it is called the Nate Bargatze Show.
Yes.
So, and you get it in this world where you're like, if I want an iced coffee in the morning, it's just there when I get there. Like, I'm not even asking, you know, like everything is like that. So you try to always, like, be very aware that this stuff's happening and, like, then also being very appreciative and make sure that you're like saying that stuff. Cause it is tough. And there's a lot of stuff on your show. I mean, I remember when the night we taped, I almost cried before we taped cause it was so overwhelming.
Yeah.
Like it was, you know, I started and I wanted to be Seinfeld and then now I'm doing this sitcom and then you're like, it's happened, you know, it's here. It's taken 16 years, but it's happened. And then your name is on this thing. You're like, you know, when you think about it, you're like, if I'm the only person that can't leave this show.
Right, yeah.
Everybody else can leave.
Right.
I'm the only, if I stay, then we do this. Like, I can, you know, it's like, I used to have a joke about quitting and staying in comedy. I was like, it's a weird job because there's no one, I don't have anybody to quit to. Like, I can't call Seinfeld and be like, I'm out. Like, there's nobody to quit to. And so it's a very weird kind of thing. And then you're doing this job now where you're like, if I quit, all these people like don't work here now and they have to go find different jobs and they have to go do different things. It was wild. But you also got to do a good product. You got to do a good thing. I mean, the best way that I feel like we're doing this show is you always want to go like this show would change my life. If it goes, it would change my life wildly. But that being said, if I didn't have this show, I'm going to be fine too.
Yeah.
And like you always want to get to that point to where you go, you want to almost when you do a show, you want to like, cause then you can work on it being like, hey, I don't need this show. I think it gives a better product instead of being like, please let me, I need the show so bad. Like, you know, that was like when you're doing spots, when you're making $20, never wanted to be like, I have to have this $20. I'm not going to eat tonight. Like you just, you know, I'd have a day job. I would figure a way out. But like, so doing this show is like, you'd like to get to a point where you're like, look, I don't need this. If this doesn't go, like, I'm going to be fine. I'll keep doing my stand up. That being said, I want this show to go more than anything.
Yeah.
I absolutely do. But it's nice to be able to do it and not have the weight of my life depending on this show.
I get it completely now. And it's also wild to be when you guys turn it in, to be at the beck and call of your phone when you don't know when you're going to get the word, right? Like I remember before Lockett got picked up, right? I did a bunch of pilots with Fox on the Fox Sports lot, and you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. I did two different Outkick shows, and you do it. You think you put a good product out there, and then things can change. Like, right, you mentioned that you got caught up in the Fox-Disney interlude. Well, you know, they changed the leadership of Fox Sports, and so there's different people making decisions, and, you know, it's like being a player on a franchise, right? If the coach likes you, the coach is going to be able to maybe build around you and, like, they create a system for you and everything else, or you're just some other guy, you know, another recruit, and they're like, yeah, I don't really think this guy's going to execute my game plan that well. And so when you're waiting on that stuff, it's like every time your phone buzzes, you, like, skip over, right? You're like, oh, my God, is this
– yeah.
Like, what's the news?
Every time you get a 310.
You're like, oh, it's somebody in Beverly, somebody in LA. Like, who's this going to be?
Yeah.
Is this going to be it? And so it's a crazy process to be in, but it's a good spot to be in where you're like, if it happens, that's awesome. I want it to happen more than anything. But if it doesn't happen, my world's not going to end.
Yes, it's that, and that's what you want to do. You want to build yourself up to be like, you always want to be in control, especially in something like this, like something that's not the norm. But maybe even if it is the norm, yeah, it feels nice to be in control, to be like, all right, I've created this thing. That's why I'm staying up so good. That's why I'm so glad I'm not an actor. An actor's entire life is just waiting.
Yeah.
Just waiting to see if you get something. You're either going to make zero money or maybe $10 million.
Right.
Like it's, you know, it's like, and you're just always waiting for that kind of like thing. You're either not famous. Now you're Tom Cruise. Like, you know, it's like, and you're just always waiting. Like, so I'm glad like to have that outlet to be with stand up. That's why I stuck with stand up. Like I knew a lot of guys when they were starting, people would do like different videos or different this or different that. And then they would do stand up. And I was like, well, I should just be great at one thing. Like yeah. If I could be great at one thing, that opens doors to everything. But if I'm just whatever, if I'm like, you know, also being like, well, I do this and I do that and I'm making these sketches and I'm trying to like, you know, see what lands. It's like, well, that's not going to, you know, it's a Steve Martin, be undeniable. That's what he always said. That's what you got to get to, be undeniable. And then all the doors will open because you're bringing something to the table. Then if I never got this show before, and it was like it was brutal because it was, I probably couldn't have handled this show. But now it's nice to get it. And then you're like, oh, yeah, you actually bring something to the table. Like you actually have an audience and fans, you know.
We're talking to Nate Bargatze. This is Wins and Losses. It's interesting. Like the reason why I haven't given up writing, a lot of people who start doing radio and start doing TV, they decide, you know, I'm not going to write anymore because writing is tough. I've continued to write. But it's funny you mentioned that because I remember the first time I went out to Fox, they had a Terranea Resort, which is a fabulous place out in L.A., and they had everybody who's on Fox Sports was showing up because it was the launch of FS1. And so, like, there's Troy Aikman, and there's Jimmy Johnson, and there's Michael Strahan, and, like, every famous person you can think of that's ever been associated with Fox Sports. Aaron Andrews, who at least I knew a little bit. Joe Buck. You know, like, all these just massive, huge, famous people. And I remember having, like, an almost mini panic attack because I'm there, and I'm like, oh, my, what am I doing here? Like, I feel like, am I sure I'm 30, you know, 3 or whatever I am? But I'm like, at that point, I had been working, you know, for a long time to kind of get an opportunity there. But I was like, am I supposed to be doing television? Like, and so what I was getting at with the Nate Bargatze show is, and I think this is very LA and Hollywood related, it's very hierarchical. So you mentioned, like, if I want an iced coffee, it's going to show up there. Trying to treat everybody the exact same has always been, I think maybe that's an innate Nashville trait, at least of our generation. Like, is something that I try to aspire to do, whether it's the 22-year-old PA who has just started or, you know, the president of a network. And it's just, it's such an overwhelming experience that sometimes you're like, you know, I don't know. Do you understand what I'm meaning? Like, it's even hard to quantify.
Like, yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Like,
yes.
Like growing up, like learning to be nice like that.
Yes.
And then whatever level you're at, you treat everybody like that, and everybody just wants to work with you. Everybody would just, and then eventually when you get higher, like it's like the work experience is wonderful because everybody feels like, oh, it's a nice place to work.
Right.
Is that what you mean? Like growing up, like,
yes.
Yeah. It's like, you're just like, growing up here, you know, we grew up, it's, you know, it's just, everybody's normal. Everybody's doing their own thing. And you just like, but everybody's very polite and nice to people, which I always think Nashville's too, sometimes it can be, I think it's too nice.
Yeah.
Like that's like, you know, where it's like no one driving, no one's going, no one's honking. And it's like a nightmare because you're like, everybody's being too polite. Yeah. And like, you know, people are not even like near, like if they're pulling out of a store, someone's like, nah, come on out. You're like, they're not even up there yet, dude.
Yeah, right.
So, but they want to let that person go. But it translates into like regular business where it's you just are more appreciative and then people are willing to help more, which produces the best product.
Yeah. And I guess I should say, like, people may be listening to this right now and they're like, Clay Travis, you're a total asshole. And I don't think that's true, but I certainly don't think that's true for people that I work with. Right. Like, I'm in the opinion business. So sometimes I might have to be you know, brusque, and certainly in social media or my radio show or television or whatever else in the way I deliver my opinion. But it's important to me that the people that I work with, like, don't hate their job, right? In fact, they like hanging out and they have a good time and it's a good environment. And I could tell, even in the limited amount of time that I've spent around you, that your show would be like that. All right, we've been talking for a while. I want to get to just a couple more things. What's the impact of Netflix now like for a comedian? What did getting your special on Netflix do for your career? How important is that?
It's huge. I mean, it changed. That was the first big change in my career. And I did the half hour on the stand-ups. At that point, I already did an hour on Comedy Central. And Comedy Central was always great. But they aired my special on my hour on Comedy Central. They aired it the same night of the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight. Like, it was, I didn't even watch it.
Yeah.
I watched the fight. Like, nobody watched it. So when that happens, the Comedy Central can sometimes make it, you know, they don't re-air it 1,000 times. So people cannot even know that I even have that. And then, so when I went to half hour Netflix, at first I was like, I don't want to go down there. I just did an hour. I don't want to go to a half hour. But I knew Netflix was this big force in stand up. And so I knew, I was like, look, I'm going to get more people to probably see that. If I'm lucky, then I would. So I did a thing called the stand ups, and it was like six of us, and we all did a half hour. And so that was the first thing. And that was pretty immediate. Like, I remember the first time on the road, maybe 2 weeks after it aired on Netflix, like, my shows were like, it wasn't they, like Friday, like Saturday night was sold out, and I could tell they knew who I was. And they were there for that reason. So, like, you just, you know, it's not crazy, but you slowly start building. And then I did that hour special, and it was, you know, and now it's jumped to a very big, like, now we're doing theaters, and, you know, I just did Salt Lake and Denver, and you walk out and everybody knows you, and the crowd is excited when you walk out. And it's because Netflix, because your stand-up just stays up there. It's just always sitting there. And so people flip around Netflix, and then they catch you, and they're like, oh, I think I heard about this guy. I always said you want to be the guy, like, you remember when you go to comedy clubs, and you could be like, oh, yeah, I think I know who that guy is. Like, that's your first, like, thing, is just to be that. Like, where you're like, oh, yeah, I think I know who that guy is. And then you just keep going forward. But Netflix is, I mean, it's given stand-ups where they just can do stand-up comedy. They don't have to do other things.
So, and this may be the last question, because I'm just kind of fascinated by the process. So you have an hour, let's say, stand-up special. Do you feel obligated to let that hour disappear and, like, not do that material again, as probably millions of people will see it on Netflix? And, yes, they love it. But do you feel an obligation to go back and recreate something new, or do you keep those jokes and keep them forever? Like, a Seinfeld, for instance, would be a guy who, if he has a joke that he really likes and he's refined it and he uses it, he'll use it over and over and over again at his stand-up act. What is your process now? Like, when you do a full hour special on Netflix, is it your idea that, like, okay, that's gone and now it's time to go back to the drawing board and come up with new stuff? Or do you think you'll use this stuff from a 1 hour special for the next 15 years, 10 years of your career, or whatever it may be?
Yeah, it's gone. It's like, so now when I go out on tour, I do an hour of new stuff.
Yeah.
And then I've been doing like an encore where I come out and I'll do 10 minutes of old jokes. Some of them are from my old Comedy Central special. I'll do like iced coffee with milk is like my big joke that everybody likes. So like I'll do like that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's gone. I mean, like, when you first, you know, I'll do the same act until it goes on something. You'll do the same act for as long as you can.
Yeah.
But then once you, especially when people are now coming because of you, if you look, they can even say they want to see that old stuff, and they could be like, I wish you would do, you know, but you will lose people dramatically if you do not create new things. If they go and see you, and, you know, right when the special comes out, I was probably at like 40, I could do 40 new minutes, and yeah, not all of it's great. But I could do like 40 new minutes, and then I would maybe have to do 20 from the special. And then you slowly get that out. And so now I do like I can do an hour new, and I would say 30 of it could be special worthy. And then the front 30 is kind of like, you know, some of the stuff I've even said on this, talking to you, like the Conan story, like I'll just tell some stories and you, whatever, just like some filler at the beginning, just like trying to be funny and making it funny. And then I'll slowly just be working in new stuff until I can have that whole new hour. So you have to turn it over. If you don't turn it over, I mean, Louis C.K. started, I don't think guys, like they're trying to put out a special every year. And I always thought that was too much. Like no one needs that. So I think it's like, you know, you probably every 2 to 3 years, you know, depending on what's going on in your career, if I get this show, then I'll probably back off completely. And like, I'll probably just hang on to this hour I have just so I can tour with it. If I'm working on the show, I would just hang on to my new hour and then wait to put it back out. Cause I don't need to put a special out cause I will have a TV show. But if
and
I
all
have
your
a,
creative energy is being poured into trying to do the television show as
yeah,
opposed to doing a stand-up.
It's a different mindset. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just a completely different, like, how you create. Like, when I, yeah, when you're creating jokes, you're, like, you're thinking of stories and stuff like this. And when you're creating a show, I'm thinking of, like, the parents, that, you know, different. It's just a different kind of mindset. And so I would just dive into that and give that my 100%. And then stand up, just kind of hold this new hour. And that way I could still tour some to just kind of keep active. But I have an hour that no one sees. But if this show doesn't go, then I'll probably shoot to try to tape a special the end of 2020, maybe 2021, and try to, you know, have that come out probably 2021 would be like the next one. And then that would be like 2 years. If you do a special every 2-3 years.
All right, so end thing here. First of all, I think the pilot's going to get picked up. So I think it will. And if it doesn't, at some point it's going to happen. But if the Nashville show pilot gets picked up, my request to you is I want to play myself at some point on the show. Can you allow me to have a line or two at some point when the pilot gets picked up and you got multiple episodes where I have in some way a role on the show?
Yes, we do this Wins and Losses podcast where I'd be the guy from Wins and Losses.
Yeah, or I can, you know, be in some way just write in a reason. And that also gives you a reason to talk about sports on the show, too. It can be golfing. It can be something related. But that's my only request.
It's a big request. Your only request is to be on a network sitcom.
That's it. They had me on Blue. First of all, I can't act, so they had me on Blue Mountain State. I got to play myself on Blue Mountain State. I didn't know anybody affiliated with Blue Mountain State, and I got to come on and play myself. So I don't think it's an outlandish request, but it is a.
I'll do it. Yeah, the two Moss Wright Park guys.
Yes,
I'll get you. We're have you on the show.
The odds would have been low on two people playing baseball at Moss Wright Park, working on the Fox lot in Los Angeles, if we've been setting odds.
The odds that one of those teams made it to the Little League World Series is through the roof, plus two of the guys that played for that team.
Yeah, to end up working on the Fox lot at the same time. All right, so this has been fantastic. You can go follow Nate. Your Twitter handle is just at Nate Bargatze, right? And I'll tweet it out, obviously, when this podcast goes up. But I encourage people to go check out the Netflix special. And hopefully, like if the pilot gets picked up, is that something you just tweet out? I don't have any idea how that works. Are you just like, hey, guys, I've got a TV show now? Like, so just watch your Twitter feed, and that's how you'll...
Yeah, it'll be announced. It'll be announced in the... We would definitely be letting everybody know. So
outstanding. Awesome, man. Well, congrats. I've loved it. The congrats on all the success, and it's awesome to get to watch. And I appreciate all the time today. I think people are going to love this.
Yeah, man. Thanks, dude. I appreciate it too.
If you enjoyed this, I'm Clay Travis. It's a Wins and Losses podcast. We talk to people about the wins and losses in their careers and how they ended up where they did. You can go listen to this one, obviously. You just did, and there's lots of others, whether it's Colin Cowherd, Jason Whitlock, Kirk Herbstreit. We've had some fun convos, so hope you enjoy it. I'm Clay Travis, and this has been Wins and Losses.